with another interesting interview today with Arnie Kronenberger in Marina del Rey, California. The date today is August 29th, 1996. And we're enjoying a beautiful stay here in beautiful Southern California. So, Arnie, if you can get out from under the sunshade, let's tell me about what's going on with about your previous life before square dancing, where you're born and brought up, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, thank you, Bob. I was born and raised in Minneapolis. I lived there for the first 17 years of my life. We came out to California in 1942. My brother was out here in the Marine Corps. He didn't list in the Bay after Pearl Harbor. And so my mother decided she wanted to spend the rest of her days in California. So having just graduated from high school on June 4th, I believe it was, we left June 6th to drive to California, which we did, and we were able to see my brother before they departed, I should say, for what ultimately turned out to be the Solomon invasion, the third Marine invasion. And then, etc. I was drafted into the Army from California and spent the first year in Battle Creek, Michigan, and the East Coast, Philadelphia. While I was stationed in Philadelphia, I met my future wife to be Jan, and we were married in 1943 in New Orleans.
Okay.
I went overseas. She went home. She was pregnant, had her child, her son, her first child, Bob. And after the war, I got out of the service on December 24th, 1945. And Jan joined me in California here, and we were in California, all of our, the rest of our lives. Jan has since passed away, unfortunately, and she's been gone now for 23 years. But she was ultimately the person who got us involved in square dancing.
Okay.
We had bought a home in West L.A., Westwood, and this was just after the war, 1948, a couple of years after the war, 3 years. And UCLA was canvassing the area for rooms for students, etc. And we had an extra room. Our second child hadn't been along yet. And we had an extra bedroom. Rented it out to a gentleman, a young kid then by the name of Dave Shiftman. And Dave was a member of our church and introduced us, or suggested to Jan and myself, that we moved into a new area, didn't know anybody, etc., had to make new friends. There was a square dance group forming, and it might be a good idea to meet kids our own age, etc. I went along with my heels dug into the ground, scratching and clawing all the way. And our instructor was Bob Osgood. Bob had been involved with the group during the war, and I think you can probably go back to Bob's tape to get all that information.
Sure.
But we ultimately joined a square dance class, which was $10 for 6 lessons, once a week, every Tuesday. And we did the 6 weeks, and then we signed up for another 6 weeks to relearn what we learned in the first 6 weeks. It was very simple. I mean, square dancing then was very, very simple. Easy.
This wasn't a continuation, this was a repeat.
was kind of a repeat, yeah. Bob stretched it out probably a little bit because there wasn't an awful lot of material at that time. And we were relying on, you know, the old time square dancing, which you find in Patton Square, that stuff. So, long story short, sometime in that period, Bob invited him to a party one night. Bob invited anybody who wanted to try calling him to come on the truck. And one of the gals, Betty Lewis, got up and grabbed one off. Which was great. And I said, well, that's easy, I'll try. And I was very shy at the time, and still am, but nevertheless, much, much shyer then. And I took a hold of that mic, and it was like a snake. I couldn't hold it still and shake it back and forth. I could only get every other word out, and that one was missing the mic, so I said right there and then that I'd never be a caller. And in the meantime, we got involved with an exhibition group that Bob had. We did some TV work, et cetera. Bob made a movie. And we were just enjoying it, having fun square dancing. Then Jan became pregnant with our second child, and I decided then that I wouldn't have a partner for much longer. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe calling isn't such a bad idea. This is back in the days when nobody knew anything about calling. There were no classes, there wasn't anything. The top calling. And with the help of Bob, Bob had sets in order then. They were getting calls daily, working on it. And Bob would say, well, we know of a caller who's forming a group, but you know, here's his name, give him a call, etc. Long story short, I lined up six squares of people who didn't know how to square dance, charged them $10 in advance, collected $240, and with that I paid rental on the hall of $60. I paid $110 for a 25-watt Newcomb outfit. Spent the rest of the money on books and records, and there were not an awful lot of those at the time either. And with what money was left over, I bought some cases of coats for a refreshment period during the 6 week classes. And that's how I got started. Now, this was in 19. We started square dancing in 1948, right about 48. And I started calling in early 49, I guess. 49. Our daughter was born in 49, so that makes sense. And I really got into calling because I needed the money for one thing. And secondly, I wasn't going to have a partner, but I wanted to stay in Spartans. My thought was if I could get one job a week calling, and you know, paying $15 a night then, that's $60 a month extra, and that's a good living and existing because I was making the magnificent sum of $225 a month then. The one night turned into five nights, six nights, seven nights, sometimes twice on Sundays. And little by little, I learned how to call, much to the, with the help of Gilmore, Osgood, Ralph McShiner, all good friends. I realized I liked what Ed was doing in his calling and his style. I had a musical background when I was in school. I played percussion and ended up playing trumpet in the school band. So I knew about phrasing, that type of thing. And with Ed's tutorage and one thing or another, we did an awful lot of talking together over a long period of time. I picked up what Ed was doing. They used to say if you can't get Gilmore, get Cronenberg. It really sounds exactly like it.
Yeah.
And then after, gosh, that was maybe 2 or 3 years, I heard a Joe Louis record. And I was absolutely dumbfounded that anybody could be that good, that loose, and yet as the style of calling, just as Joe's style of calling, just intrigued the heck out of me. So I started consciously or unconsciously, started incorporating some of what Joe was, his style, along with what Ted had been doing, and melded the two together, I guess. And in time, it became a style, my style. And at that point, probably 5 years into calling, I think I became a fairly successful caller. Called for another 20 years before I retired. But it was the combination of Ed and Joe, both of whom are now gone, and both of them were dear, dear friends. Ed first, of course. And then Joe and I became very close and did a lot of things together. And I just enjoyed calling. When I got into calling, initially, it was as a hobby, and I kept it as a hobby. I've always had a daytime job. I relied on calling for a livelihood outside of maybe 1 month in the 25 years when I was unemployed. But I always said if it ever got to be a job, I'd quit, because I didn't need 2 jobs. And it got to that point along about 1970, 71. It was becoming less and less enthralling to go out and call a square dance anymore. It was a job, and I found myself trying to prove myself every day. I went out on a weekend, and I went out on a date somewhere in the country, whatever it might have been. And it stopped. It actually stopped being fun, and I made up my mind probably in 71 to quit, retire. But I was booked for 2 years ahead, and it took me 2 years to work my way through the rest of my bookings. And let's see, my last calling job was New Year's Eve of 73. Have not tried it since. This, the people involved in it, did not necessarily miss the activity. It became very complex, very competitive, and actually, for me, the joy of it went out of the activity.
You must have been involved in movie making a little bit.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I still get a check. This is gosh. 20, 30 years. I did a voiceover for Henry Mancini. He was the musical director for a picture called The Thief Who Came to Dinner. With Ryan O'Neill, I think, the star. And I went into Warner Brothers and did a voiceover. And for which I still get 1 or 2 checks every year. Now the checks are only $10 a pop, but the time to take out the taxes and one thing, the check is like $5.70 or something like that.
Right.
Screws up my income tax every year. Prior to that, I did an album. I had done some recording for Sessional and Bob, and we had a good time doing those. Then I was invited by Warner Brothers to do an album in stereo, which sounded exciting. And we went in and did, gosh, the band that we had that night was, well, we did 2 sessions. The first night we did five singles. And the band was just absolutely amazing. They had asked me who I wanted in the band. They said, your leader's going to be Ernie Police. Ernie was an accordionist. Great reputation. Real fine musician. He said, but, you know, tell us who you want, we'll get it for you. Well, I knew Red Callender, or reputation of Red Callender. And so I said, how about Red Callender? No problem. So Red was our bassist. The piano player was a gentleman by the name of Paul Smith. Paul was, he always recorded with Ella Fitzgerald. Ella wouldn't do a date without him practically. And I guess he did an awful lot of recording with Sinatra too. But he, Paul was a big guy, a strapping guy. He had a hand in the feature. Maybe two octaves, or at least an octave and a half. And yet his fingers were so light. If you ever hear his hear him play, you'll have to recognize him because his style is very distinguished. And Joe Mavis on five string banjo. And I can't remember the drummer's name. But the music was just absolutely great. It was fantastic. Then the next session we did was the patter calls. And I brought in Jack Carter, who had been a fiddle player for me and several other colleagues in the area for some time. And Jack was kind of an old, Jack was young, but he was what I called a Missouri hoedown fiddler. Couldn't read music or anything else. All he knew was to play the fiddle. Well, for the hoedowns, they had, the band, Ernie Police, had arranged the hoedowns. Jack couldn't cut it. He didn't know what he was doing. So I went to Ernie and I said, look, we spent an hour messing around here already. Why don't you let Jack saw her off and you guys come and follow it behind us? So we did that and it worked perfectly. And an hour and a half later, we had five sides ready to go. The album sold very well. I still have a couple of copies of it. It's not available anymore. It was called Stereo Blues Square Dancing, I guess. And it was fun. We were involved in two or three other projects that we did locally here. Callers, Breakfast, at the LA Athletic Club, and we brought in a couple of speakers. It was kind of a Dale Carnegie type meeting to help bring out the best of the call or whatever. And that was successful. Then we also were involved with doing a two or three day session at UCLA for callers. Again, it was not necessarily teaching callers how to call, but all of the other things that go into being a good leader, etc. And I guess maybe last but not least, Bob and myself, Van Antwerp, Lee Helsel, got involved in the start of Caller Line. Gilmore and I, Bob and I, Bob and Ed, we'd always talked about getting a group together or forming a group of national callers. And there was a lot of pros and cons. As I recall, Ed was not necessarily in favor of it because he thought the square dancing was a folk activity and should be left at that, not, you know, try and organize it not like this. And we agreed along that line. But it finally got to the point where we thought a group could do a lot of good. While Caller Lab has not probably done exactly everything that we thought it could do, I think it's working well. We were starting at 35 cent standpoint practice. And our first meeting was in Selamar, 11 callers, no more Lewis, myself, Bob, Dave. Van was there, and Nelson was there. Bob and Van and Lee and I did most of the groundwork up to that point. That was our first meeting, maybe the second year, and we doubled the number up to 25 or 6 callers who came to that one. And from that point, we established, I think, the first caller lab, which was 1974. And it's taken off. It's become a big international group now. We've done a lot of good things. I have not been in touch with the program before. When I retired in 73, and again in 73, I haven't paid much attention to it after that. I have been to 2 or 3 of the meetings when I was one, back in Philadelphia, the other in Miles and North, and the other two, one in meeting, one was in Vegas. They're having it out here next year, so. God willing, I'm still around. I'll take that one.
Yeah, I'm going to try to make that one too. Even though I'm not a member.
Same idea.
Yeah. But I want to pursue this interview thing, and I'm sure there'll be a tassel up there. But were you, you must have been at the time of Jubilee?
Yeah, that was 1950. Two, I believe.
I believe so.
We had about, crowd estimate then was about 15,000 dancers and about 35,000 spectators. It was done in Santa Monica at, we blocked off, or I say we, 4 blocks of Wilshire going east and west were blocked off, so the caller stand was at the apex of Ocean Boulevard, I think it was Ocean Boulevard,
yeah,
Wilshire. So as you're standing there, you're looking down 4 blocks of Wilshire Boulevard, and a block either way on Ocean Park or Ocean Boulevard. And it was jammed, it was packed up. The clubs hired buses to bring them in. And it was, the police were, they had more than police there than they, what they thought would be needed for crowd control. And everything was so orderly that halfway through the night, the police force was down to a half dozen, something like that. It was quite a sight. Pappy came in for it, acted as MC, master of ceremonies. And it was an exciting time. I've never seen that many dancers in one spot before or since. And from what I understand, it's pretty hard to get together a half a dozen square times.
Yeah, right. And any overseas trips?
No. No, I didn't call outside of the states. I called in all 48 of the contiguous states over a period of time. And we did a lot of festivals. I started touring back around 54, 55, somewhere in there. Well, 54, actually, because I did. Well, I did. We did do Canada. I did a 75th anniversary. The 75th anniversary for the province of Alberta, and it's based out of Edmonton. And we did 21 nights in 23 days, or 2 days off. Jan went with me, and we had a ball. They gave us a government car to drive. We drove something like 3,000 or 3,500 miles within the province, and then we flew up to Peace River and Grand Prairie in the north. That's where the sun never set. This was in June of 54. And that was exciting. That was different. Visited little towns at Provost. My gosh, if you've got a mile off the main drag, you were driving on gravel, and if you have another mile off the main drag, you were driving just on dirt.
Yeah.
And trying to find some of these places. Something else. And then I remember we St. Paul, which is due, I believe it's due east of Edmonton, is a Russian French community. And you couldn't call a mixer of any type because you couldn't mix the Russians into the
place.
So the Russian population sat on one side of the hall and the French population sat on the other side of the hall. And never did the twains meet. I mean, you couldn't do a one-night stand mixer type thing. So that was, it was different. It presented a little bit of a challenge, but it was fun. The other thing that the NBC called, I forget the dates on this now, they were out in the valley still, except they called me and wanted to know if I would do a job for them on the day of Garraway, the old day of Garraway,
yeah.
Sunday morning show.
Yeah.
I said, doing what? And they said, well, we've got a 4 helicopter who have a square dance quote unquote routine. We want you to call to them. And even though I was in touch with the commander of the group, those 4 bells, they were an icebreaker reconnaissance group or something like that. They worked in Alaska most of the time in the spring. This, I think, was probably in March. I don't recall the year. Anyhow, I stood on the roof of one of the NBC buildings, and they were right at that level, working at that level off the ground, which was maybe 30 feet off the ground. And they would move in unison to the left, circle right, heads in and out, sides in, out, etc., etc. They gave me the routine, and I put a call to it. And the end of it was that they would peel off out over the parking lot and come back straight into the camera. The camera was looking, I was standing in front of the camera looking over my shoulder. And on the practice thing, they did that, and it came in, and they were probably 30 feet over my head, something like that. The day we did it, the Sunday morning we did it, those suckers, after the routine was over and they peeled off and come back into the camper, they came back into the camper about 5 feet over my head, at which point I was flat on the deck. The cameraman, bless his heart, he had to stand there and take it. But those guys came as close as they could come. And it was exciting. It was exciting. It was different. It was fun. And goes into my book of memoirs,
I guess. I guess. You mentioned such an order of recordings. Did you record for anybody else?
Just Warner Brothers. Just the one album for Warner Brothers. I have, I made, I don't know, 5 or 6 albums for Bob, and I made probably a dozen or so singles. I used to be the actors, the recording head when we were recording at the college. I forget some of them. Well, Jim York recorded. Bob, section owner. Helsel did. John Bruce did because he was with Lindsay. Van did. Anyhow, I've helped record these guys. And I think one of the best singles I ever had. We used to use Jack Hawes and Lynette Brazil for live music. We would have about a 14 service bass, fiddle, piano, and banjo. And one time a caller was late in getting there, so we were eating up studio time. So I had the band come in and get together, and so let's just, I'll try and record something without banjo. The dancers in here, my guy. And so we did two sides, and we did, just call. We didn't do a retake or anything else. When the dancers got there, we put the tape on and they danced to it, and it was the best single album or single record I think ever made.
Very good.
The timing was fantastic. Yeah. We were doing just kind of to phrase it.
Right.
And it worked very, very well. I was real proud of that.
Couldn't very well call a phrase to the helicopter.
No. I had to go by their movement,
yeah.
Pretty much. But it worked very, very well. These guys were good. Matter of fact, after it was over, the commander, and he was a commander, a paper commander, took me for a ride. And this little Bell helicopter, first time I'd ever been in a small helicopter. And he turned the helicopter a little bit loose. I mean, he did everything that he could do. He was a hell of a pilot. And that was really exciting. I mean, he did dives and twirls and spins. And I did initially, obviously.
Yeah.
That was my learning curve, my time. And at the time, of course, if you were going to have a backyard party or a patio party, it was usually going to be a squirt engine one. And you were hired to do a one-night stand or whatever. I taught the early days of my calling, Bob and I taught at Beverly Hills High School when square dancing was a fad. Evidently, Beverly Hills adult education program, they got enough requests to teach square dancing that Bob and I were hired to do it. Bob was hired initially to do the job. But there was such a great response that they needed somebody else. So Bob asked me if I would come with him, and work too. Well, we did. And we worked out, I was there probably 3 years, somewhere between 3 and 4 years, teaching every Friday night at Beverly Hills High School. Bob stayed on for another year or so after I left. Quite frankly, by then, the demand had diminished. But we ran Full House, which was about 30 squares.
In
2 years at least,
yeah,
before it started to slack off.
In each gym?
Yeah, we had two gyms, boys' gym and the girls' gym, and they were right next door to each other. And Bob had a full house, and I had a full house when we finished. I think we were set up then for 10 weeks of lessons. And then we would go, anybody who wanted to continue, we would combine them into what we called an intermediate class. And one over the other was, we'd take that, and the other one would take on the new beginning dance. And that went on for, as I say, 3 or 4 years. Out of that group, out of those classes, I met a gentleman and his wife by the name of Gene and Riley Perry. And we became very good friends socially. And we started teaching at Beverly Hills High School about 51, 52. And in 1954, right, he asked me to come to work for him. I was then working for Bob in such an order. So, rightly, I asked Riley, I said, what do you want me to do? I had been an accountant, used to that end of things. He said, sell it. I said, you got your goddamn. Long story short, I worked with him. Started July 1st of 54, and I'm in my 42nd year now in the business that I'm in. Been in it for 42 years. Rightly and union both passed away. But square dancing, in effect, was responsible for my being 42 years in my current job. I've been with two firms, one with the first 25 years, 24 and a half years, with Rightly's company. And and I left there to join the firm I'm with now, and I've been in this firm October of the 18th year. So it's, you know, I really can't jump around a lot.
The just for a second, getting back to one night stands, I wanted to ask in there, we lost the track somehow. Any of these one night stands with any of the movie stars?
Well, again, out of the first, out of my very first class that I charged $10 a lesson for 6 weeks, there was a couple in it. He was a corporate attorney, and they wanted to form a group of their own to dance at their home, which was in Bel Air. And so we did that, and out of that experience, I think that Lee used to live in Hermosa Beach or something like that, Lee Helson. And Lee was transferred up to Sacramento because eventually he became head of California State Mental Health Program. And when Lee left, he called in and asked me if I wanted to take over this group that he had. And I said, sure, whatever. You know, what is it? He said, well, they're just Hollywood people that like to get together down and score dance. So I said, sure. So I called for this group for about 5 years, I guess, something like that. We danced, we danced once a month, I think. And every night was kind of like a one-night stand because none of them ever became, even back then, became proficient dancers.
Yeah.
But it was a matter, it was a way for them to get together. And we danced in their home. We rotated around in their home. We had, I met Charles Maston for the first time when he was fresh out of Northwestern University. He came to the group. His wife then was carrying their first child. Milgram Stone was in the group, who was Doc on Gunsmoke.
Oh, yeah.
Jim Arness, who was Matt. Jim and I graduated from high school together.
Oh,
James King Arnett. And he was a tall, gangly kid that you could see in the hallway from one end of the building to the other because he was so tall and skinny. He really filled out very nicely. But Jim and I graduated together in West High in Minneapolis. Gene Cagney, Jimmy's brother, or sister, pardon me. We had a lot of writers and directors, producers. Gene Barry was a member of the group. One of the one that I worked with this group for a period of time. It was it broke up because of the communist scare in Hollywood, and it kind of split down the middle. They just it took sides. One of the one night stands, though, that you asked about, did I ever do one night stand? I was invited to do a birthday party for the daughter of Vladimir Horowitz. And we danced at Edna Best's home that night. And the party was for the daughter, who was, I think, turning 16 or something like that. And she had all her young friends. Well, along with all her young friends was practically the whole English colony of Hollywood. Reginald Gardner. I can't think of them all. But this particular night, Vivian Leigh and Olivia
Orson
were there. He was here doing Streetcar Named Desire, or she was doing Streetcar Named Desire. Anyhow, they were both in Hollywood at the same time, doing different pictures. And during the evening, as I was calling, Olivier would be watching. And he was intrigued, and kind of unnerved me, but nevertheless, it was also interesting. He asked me when dinner was served, and believe me, I was not supposed to be in the middle of the dinner table. But he said, come sit next to me at the dinner table, I want to talk to you some more. And so I sat between Olivier and Vivian Leigh at dinner, which kicked off at the best no end. I was a hired hand, I was not supposed to be there. But I was there at Olivier's behest. I wasn't anything she could do about it. I was caught between a rock and a hard place, and I guess so was she. But that was, we had a nice talk. He wanted to know about my breathing and about my phrasing, how I would do this and how I did that. And it's, you know, it was interesting as all get out.
That's certainly unique, yeah.
So I did have dinner with Leigh and Olivia one night.
There you go. The pinnacle of your career.
Yeah. Well, it was an interesting time. I thoroughly enjoyed 23 of the 25 years. The last 2 years, I was able to maintain enthusiasm and all that good stuff, but I had made up my mind that I just wanted out, and it got me a job. Period. It wasn't funny.
I wanted to ask you about the beautiful artwork you have around your home here. Now, before we get into that, I know one of your prized possessions came from Chuck Jones, and you were also affiliated with him as it relates to square dancing.
Well, Chuck belonged to one of my groups. Out of the first of Selamar, which was 1952, I believe, came a group of people who had really met for the first time. Chuck and Dottie, a couple by the name of Don and I, and Carter. And there were maybe 10 couples of us that got together at the Harders one night after a Selamar to form a group. And the group, I named the group Rinky Dance. And it was my home club. and they lasted for 20 years. Right at the time I quit.
They danced at such an order.
And we danced, well, we danced in several places, but we ended up, ultimately ending, we ended up dancing at the Sets and Order Home. We had been at the school playground hall for, I think, a couple of years. I think we danced two or three places other than Sets and Order, but we were at Sets and Order for most of the time.
I think this one prize position you have of Chuck's characters.
I don't know if you. Upstairs, I have four more of Chuck's paintings and/or drawings. Chuck used to, when we were in Sealamon, Chuck would always take an afternoon. Most any time we get together with the kids and he would draw for them. I don't know, the kids still got them. I know that my daughter still has two or three of the drawings that Chuck gave her. But if they hung on to them, they're worth a lot of money.
Sure.
Chuck has become, I just heard this, he was voted one of the 10 best directors ever in Hollywood, and for an animator and cartoonist to join the ranks of Spielberg and whoever else is included is quite an honor, and Chuck has been honored. He got an Oscar, the last Oscar presentation. I went to London on vacation one time, and Chuck has decorated the wall over there at the museum, the movie museum, and it's, gosh, it's 50 feet long and 20 feet high, and he decorated the wall with his characters, Roadrunner, all that, and it's interesting. It's a cinematic museum. But he's done a lot of stuff. He was a joy. Dottie was a joy. Always a spark of the group. And we had a good time. And what I think the treasure that you're referring to is a Christmas card that Chuck sent, which is actually it's a cell of all of his characters in cowboy drag and a quote unquote saloon type thing, and it was a Christmas card. Chuck's summer tonight.
It's a beautiful piece. I think we're getting down near the end of this interview, and I wonder if you just kind of give us an overview of the picture of square dancing as you see it. You've had a little bit different experience than many of that I've talked to. So what do you think about where we've been and where we are and where we're going? Of course, you're no longer affiliated.
Well, as I say, I haven't been really in touch with it. I'm a gold card member of, first gold card member of Caller Line. And as such, I'm a lifetime member and get all of their mailings and one thing or another. I still have a vote, but I don't vote because I don't want the people involved with me now. Where we were was a lot more fun than where they are now, as far as I can tell. Even where we were initially was a lot more fun than it was when I quit 25 years ago. So it's from what I understand, it's tougher to get the group together. When I learned the square dance, when I was teaching it, it's 6 weeks, 10 weeks, 12 weeks, and you were out doing club dancing. Now, unless you go 30 weeks or 45 weeks or whatever the period of time is, it's too long a period to learn how to square dance and become proficient at it. There aren't, gosh, when I started, we had the whole city hall, council of Beverly Hills, etc., in our classroom. Doctors, lawyers could give up a night a week or 6 weeks, or whatever it was, to learn how to square dance because it wasn't that difficult. Now they don't have the time, and they know that it's going to take them a year to even become partly sufficient in dancing. They're going to say, screw it, I don't have that much time to do it. Back then, teaching, if you missed a night, you could still pick up the next time around. But now, if you miss a night, man, you're setting yourself back 2 or 3 weeks or something.
That's right. Or 4 or 5 basics.
Yeah, whatever.
Right.
And I don't know all of the programs that I don't pay any attention to.
Yeah.
The A group, the B group, or whatever it is.
Right.
Caller lab is established as a teaching basis. I think we have made it, they have made it, I helped make it too complicated.
Right.
We took it out of the realm of an activity that you could easily learn into an activity that required longer time than people can afford to give.
Well, do you feel that those of us who can realize the situation all along and we're not able to stop the tide, do you think there's any way we can resurrect any sort of a stable activity in the future?
The only thing we do is my business that I'm in is based on a similar situation. And the only way to correct either one of my mistakes would be to is to just go and start your own little group and take it to a point of enjoyment without making it complex. Now, if they start going out and trying to dance around, they come back and this dancers do what they did to me, and they did all colors. So and so did this the other night. How come we don't know that? Or how come they aren't giving us that? And it's a hard place to be in as far as the caller is concerned. You're trying to keep the dancers happy, and it's kind of damn if you do and damn if you don't situation.
Right.
I don't know, obviously, what the answers are. I probably tried to drag my feet as much as I could without calling high-level, quote-unquote, square dancing.
Right.
I was never very good at it. If I had tried, I would have fallen flat on my face because it's something I just didn't do.
Yeah.
What I wanted to do. But I have no idea. As I said, it's over.
Well, Arnie, I want to thank you very much. Number one, I want to thank you for your hospitality and thank you for dinner last night. And I'm going to be on my way shortly. I'm talking to some other people on my way back to Albuquerque. But thank you so much for taking the time and having me in.
My pleasure, Bob. Good to see you again.
Thank you. Appreciate it.